Night on Arena. Lisa O'Neill plays live in studio, and director Gavin Quinn, actor Anne Gridley on Pan Pan Theatre's take on Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. +51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You can watch us on rte.ie/arena. Lisa O'Neill was last with us on the programme when she released her 2023 album, All of This is Chance. That album has since been much celebrated. Album of the Year for Gideon Coe on BBC Six Music. Highly praised by both Mojo and Bob Boylan at NPR, to mention but a few. Lisa was also a guest on Later with Jules Holland, had the honour of playing a tiny desk concert for NPR in Washington, played sold-out concerts at the National Concert Hall in London's Barbican, not to mention extensive tours of Ireland, the UK, America and Australia. And if that's not enough, this November, Lisa will perform a collection of her songs with the National Symphony Orchestra in the wonderfully titled Symphony for the Moons, which will take place at the National Concert Hall on the night of a full moon, which I just love. It's her first time to collaborate with an orchestra, but thankful to say not her first time in this studio with me. That is only skimming the surface of the last 12 to 18 months, Lisa.
Thanks, Sean, for that. Good, great to see you, by the way.
You too.
Thanks for the recap, because we do forget ourselves what we've been up to, moving so much, you know.
And when I call
musicians,
yeah, I can imagine, because you're kind of thinking, where have I to be next Tuesday or whatever it is. When I recall those outtakes, does one or other jump up and go with you? Oh, I remember that one particularly.
The Barbican in London was spectacular. It's a beautiful room. It's an amazing sounding room, you know. And I'd done a spot there before, so to go back and do my own show. The chemistry was great that night. There was just something magic going on, you know, all around. And it was a very big crowd after years and years of over and back to London, playing venues as they, over time, get a little bit bigger, maybe 20, 50 more each time. But that was a good 10, 15 years over and back with my band to build, to sell out the Barbican was a real lovely moment, yeah.
And the Jules Holland one, I think, was pretty special too, wasn't it?
Yeah,
being on with him. What was the story?
Jules is lovely.
Yeah, tell us about the little gift you brought him that I believe was quite telling.
I give him a wee bell because I do give out wee bells to people. Sean, I might even have one in my bag for you today. I think it's a lovely, it's just a lovely symbol. It's a small little instrument, isn't it? A little bing. But I gave Jules a bell anyway. And he was delighted. He said he's going to put it with his other collection of bells, which he found in his back garden. And
so he had bells already.
But these bells from the 1500s.
That he
said
found
that
in his
he
back
found.
Garden.
He had a little metal detector.
And even down the back garden.
In his back garden somewhere in London, and out comes these bells. He digs out these bells, and a neighbour of his told him they go way back to 1500. So Jules added my little bell to his old bell collection.
And do the bells,
I was happy enough with that. Like.
Absolutely, who wouldn't be? Did the bells signify something in particular for you? What do they kind of...
To ring a little bell, I wish I had one right now to shake at you. It signifies moment. Not the moment before or the moment forward, but present. Do you get me?
I do, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking, you know, we often think of the tolling bell at a funeral as the end of something. But in fact, if we thought of it the way you just described it, it becomes something else, that it's the present moment and the beginning of something else. That's makes it a much nicer bell, doesn't it?
It is, and I mean... Another way to look at all of that is, like, you know, the end of something is always the beginning of something else.
For sure.
So I'm being a bit philosophical.
Sure. There is no harm, Sean, in that. In fact, the first song that you've chosen to sing for us, tell us why you chose this song, and we listen to the lyrics, and I think they'll mean something new when you wanted to talk about a shop in Cavan that sadly is...
closing. Yeah. So the music shop in Cavan is called Multisound, and it opened in 1988, and it was always there, you know. I mean, as far as I was as far as I remember.
Did you buy records, instruments there?
I bought my first tape in there, Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill. And so all my musical education, well, and then you save up enough money and go in and get your the record that's coming out, you know, it's all very exciting. Then to, like, I can't say enough about these little record shops and how important they are, and so many of them closing, but even that shop, Noel Tierney and Multisound in Cavantown, very good to me when I put out my first couple of albums independently, you know, they put them on their shelves. This is really, this is important in young people's careers to have these stores and this kind of support at home, because it begins at home. And, you know, sure, of course, it grew from there. And I was lucky enough to eventually be signed to a record label. But that man never took a penny off me. He didn't take everything that came in for those records he gave me. He insisted on giving me every penny back.
So he didn't sell them and make a profit.
No.
He sold them and gave you the money.
Because he was invested in the local artists, and like he was with so many, with the Stripes and Áine Cathal and so many others. But it's sad to see them closing, you know. He's sad about it. Everyone's sad about it, and it's just not feasible anymore.
Mm.
Records are selling, CDs aren't selling. The whole ticket selling is gone. But it's a sense of community. These records shops, they're important, and bookshops as well. So I've decided to sing Goodnight World, a nod to. To that record shop,
which was on the last album,
week.
Wasn't it? Yeah, all of this is Chance was the last album. So this was on the album,
Chance.
And when I listen to it now, it becomes a different song. Given that story you've just told us about the music shop in Cavan, let's hear. Ooh. Goodnight World, played live in studio for us this evening by Lisa O'Neill, who's going to come over from our music position to sit over in the chair where you can get a good look at her if you're watching on rte.ie/arena. I love the whistling at the end of that track. Can I actually, I was just watching you there doing the whistle. I thought, when's she going to take a breath? Do you whistle on the exhalation and the inhalation somehow? Do you whistle on the way in as well as the way out?
I never think about it. I guess I do, but
because there's no break.
How do you take breaths between your words as well, Sean? I suppose it's the same thing.
I couldn't hear any join at all. I wondered if you were doing it. Anyway, that's by the by. It does take on a whole new meaning, doesn't it? Goodnight World. I know it's a lullaby essentially, but when you gave us the context of the shopping cabinet, it becomes something else. That's what a good song does.
Oh, it's been a good little vehicle in that way, you know. And I played for the in solidarity for the people of Palestine at the end of every show since last October. So yes, it is a bit of a it can represent a lot. A lullaby can. In general, I think.
Yeah, well, the whole idea of goodnight and saying goodbye to things brings us into a whole new realm. You were very busy last night. Let me read what the Irish Times had to say. A highlight from the new album is the shimmering, contemplative Night of the Hunter. Barrett repairs to the piano. This is referring to the Libertines gig last night to allow the Irish singer-songwriter Lisa O'Neill to accompany Doherty on vocals. So you were one of the highlights at the Libertines gig last night. The Irish Independent says they bring out Cavan folk singer Lisa O'Neill for Night of the Hunter, the best song on the new album. And even those who have doggedly resisted any affection for the Libertines are likely to be mollified during a tender edition of Music When the Lights Go Out.
Well, it's a great song. It is a great song.
I think there was a good singer singing it, though, as well with him.
There was three of us last night, Carol and Peter. And oh, it was such a treat. It was a buzz now to sing with those lads.
When did the musical relationship with the Libertines, when did that start? How did it start, or do you know?
Peter reached out to me a couple of months ago and invited me over to Margate. They have a studio in Margate to do a bit of work with him. So that was very exciting. I spent 2 days with him writing and singing and recording. So yeah, they reached out again the other day when they were coming into town. So it was brilliant. I really enjoyed the show. I'd never seen the Libertines live before. They're brilliant, and the audience were wild as well. It was a great night in the Olympia.
Yeah, that's where you were last night. Have Cillian Murphy and Margot Robbie invited you to go anywhere with them? Do you know what Margot Robbie said about the end of the seemingly on Actors and Actors interview in Variety? They were talking about you, Cillian Murphy and Margot Robbie.
I heard about that. Yeah, my ears are burning, lads.
All the Tired Houses is Margot Robbie's cry song.
All the Tired Horses, yeah.
Sorry.
She said that. I know, I'd never heard this term, cry song. Yeah, it's very funny because I told my little niece, my niece saw that clip and she turned around to my brother, her father, and said, Barbie knows Lisa. And John said, Barbie likes Lisa's music, yeah. And then she said, Barbie knows me. Because she's on the new record. She's on that record that came out last year. So she took a big leap then to Barbie Knows Her as well. And I suppose, in a way, maybe Barbie has heard of Sadie May as well. Sadie May is a proper little rock star, you know. She wrote to David Attenborough about 4 weeks ago and he wrote back to her.
What, do you mind my asking? Or do you want to say what she wrote to ask?
I will, yeah. She said something along the lines of, Dear David Attenborough, I love your programmes and I'd love to be an explorer like you when I grow up. And if you ever wanted to come and visit Cavan, I'll show you around Erica's Fairy Forest, my favourite place. And Attenborough wrote back and said, he's 98 years old. He wrote back to the six-year-old and said, thank you for your lovely letter and I'm glad you like the programmes and thank you for the invite to Cavan, but I'm afraid I won't be able to go.
She'll have to bring Erica's Forest. To him.
It was magic that he wrote back.
But isn't that brilliant that he would take the time to do that? And, you know,
he's speaking to the future generation, writing back to children, you know. They are the future.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, everything he says about the planet is speaking to that generation, mm-hmm. and hoping that we can maintain that, which touches on, well, this title, as I say, when I saw it, Songs for the Moon, I thought, where did Lisa come up with that title? Now, tell me, which came first? The dates happening to be, because you're playing in London as well, aren't you? On the night of a full moon. So both gigs are happening on the nights of a full moon. Was that pure accidental? Or
second one, a little exaggeration. The second one's around the full moon. It's about 5 days from it, but still.
It's a special moon. There's a special moon that night.
Final moon of the year. Final, and it's close to a full moon. No, the dates came first, but I will admit, I am a bit mad for the moon. Like, so usually when a show comes on the calendar, I often do look and see where the moon's at. Because I'm trying to figure out where I'll be at.
And can you measure? Is there a particular part of the cycle of the moon when now's the days? These are the days for writing. These are the days for doing nothing. And these are the days for performing. Do you have that kind of?
I might be more likely to kind of listen to my mood, and then I wonder where the moon's at. Like, for example, the other night when the actual equinox was happening, the autumn equinox, I didn't sleep a wink.
Did you not?
And it was the next day I realised the equinox was last night, and I thought, why now?
That's its experience. Yeah, I heard somebody talking about that. There's a moment on that day, I think it was at 1:47, and they were saying at that moment you can actually, it's a good time to kind of reset yourself, because there's just that split second when we're kind of in the middle.
Perfect
of things.
Perfect balance between light and dark.
Yeah.
On the autumn equinox, where the moon is. Yeah. We're halfway between light and dark, and it's a good time to take stock, I suppose. And I mean, I like these rituals because they do help us have a look at the year gone by, and our ancestors would have done that as well, but all around the harvest, you know. So
yeah,
I try and
look
at the harvest of creativity at that time.
Nice way of thinking about it, actually, and at this time of year in particular. Mm. So we are going to hear your songs orchestrated and played with. I mean, that's very exciting. You've never done the full orchestral side of things before with your own songs.
I did a little treat, actually, with the Arena maybe 10 years ago on Culture Night in Dublin Castle. I think you were there, Sean. And they did the Symphony Orchestra.
It was a concert orchestra, I think. Yeah, the RT concert orchestra on that night. Yes,
I got the sense then. Oh wow, like, you know. Yeah. So this is a full set of 12 songs.
Wow. And is it the album, or have you chosen? It's not the new. It's not the most recent album. You've kind of gone into the back catalogue as well.
Yeah, I'm going into the back catalogue. I have 5 records, so I'm visiting songs from every record bar the first one. No big reason. It was just a selection in the end, and. I can't wait. It's a bit of a dream come true, you know. I don't read music myself. Mm. And I write lyric and melody. So for someone else to write a score in all that detail.
Who's doing that, and have you been involved in it?
I mean, my involvement, it was the writing of the songs, I suppose. Yeah. Terry Edwards is doing it, and that's a man I worked with. I met him first at Shane McGowan's birthday party in the National Concert Hall, and he put all of that music together.
Yeah.
He's a London-based man. And I worked with him then again on a Tom Waits, revisiting the Tom Waits album, Swordfish Trombone. And I liked what he did. So when the concert hall offered me this, I suggested Terry, and Terry said, yeah, and he's well into it now. We're nearly there.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing it, I hope, at the time. May not have brought me in a bell, but you did bring me in a picture, which I'm holding up for those at home to see if they're looking on the camera now.
Isn't she beautiful?
Of the beautiful Margaret Barry and her banjo. Reason for the presentation of same was what?
I do carry around in my guitar.
She's there with you anyway.
Yeah. For the last year, myself and Pat Collins, the great filmmaker from Drimaleague and Cork, we've been working on a script about Margaret Barry.
So a drama? Or a documentary?
No, a film. No, not a documentary.
Right, so a fiction. Not a fiction, but, you know.
Not a fiction. I won't label it yet. She's at the heart of it.
And who might be playing Margaret Barry?
Oh, maybe I might try myself, Sean.
Why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't I?
Why wouldn't you?
I love her. And I've been I really got to know some of her grandchildren in the last year as well. And they're wonderful people and great grandchildren, wonderful musicians. And they're teaching me a lot about her.
All right. Listen, I'll get you to go back over to, because you're going to sing a new song for us. This is a brand new song that we're about to get. And I know you want to, you're changing your guitar over. Let me tell you that while Lisa's doing that, Symphony for the Moons, Lisa O'Neill with the National Symphony Orchestra, National Concert Hall on the 16th of November, as part of tradition now, and with the Britain Sinfonia at the Barbican in London on the 11th of December. Both are sold out, unfortunately. A few other gigs, Cavan Town Hall Arts Centre, 17th of October, sold out. The Linen Hall in Castlebar on the 19th, Dolan's in Limerick on the 20th. I think the Town Hall Theatre in the Galway is the one with a few tickets left, I think you said to me, Lisa, is that right? The Galway gig is the one with a few tickets still to go.
I believe so.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. Check out Lisa's website. Yeah, it sure is. LisaO'Neill.ie will give you all of the events. Sold-out dates in Cork in October. You're a great woman for the sold-out dates. So we're going to get...
I love tour in Ireland.
Yeah, well, obviously people love you doing it. You're going to sing a new song for us.
This is a new song. It's called Homeless in the Thousands.
And I think that title probably gives us a sense of where you're going with it.
Yeah, sad I had to write this song. Homeless in the thousands, worsens every day. This the state of Dublin in the digital age. They were homeless in the dozens when I was a kid. They say that things were bad then, but this is off grid. Is it cause my father went and lost his way? When he lost his wages at a Dublin Bay. Is it cause my mother had me out of wedlock, born into a laundry, never did catch up? Is it cause my landlord can't even look at me, so high up on the ladder they can't see the streets? I'm begging cause I'm hungry, I'm strung out cause I'm cold. I just want to lie down and be left alone. Say change is coming, I say change has come. No one carries change in their pockets anymore. You might spare a moment, share some poor soul's pain, meet them in the eyes at least, if you can't spare change. All our heroes would be reeling and rolling in their graves if they saw the state of O'Connell Street today. Homeless in the worsens by the day. This the state of Dublin
that age.
In the Thousands, new song from Lisa O'Neill. Lisa, thanks so much for coming in this evening. Lovely to see you as always.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Perhaps the most famous, one of the most famous or infamous of Shakespeare's stage directions is Exit, Pursued by a Bear, comes in Act 3 of The Winter's Tale, sees Antigonus meet death in the most unlikely of ways, at the hands, or rather the claws, of a bear. The stage direction is now the name of the latest production from Pan Pan Theatre, where The Winter's Tale is retold from the perspective of the bear, or maybe several bears, I think. It's all part of this year's Dublin Theatre Festival, and I'm delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Pan Pan's co-artistic director, Gavin Quinn, and founding member of Nature Theatre of Oklahoma, Anne Gridley, who joins the cast of Exit Pursued by a Bear, and I believe is making her debut in Ireland. So very welcome here indeed, Anne. Let me turn to you, Gavin, first, because it would be unfair to ask Anne to tell us about how brilliant she is. So perhaps you might tell us the sort of theatre that Anne is involved in, giving that you're sitting there, but it's easier for him to tell it, I think. Well, Anne,
I would be delighted, yeah. I mean, I first started seeing Anne on stage in around 2005, 2006 in New York, when we were also performing at a festival called Under the Radar and Coil Festival. So I saw Anne, I think, in the famous kitchen space in New York. And I saw her play, I think, Romeo and Juliet. And I've seen several productions of Anne over the years. And I would say, like, Nature Theatre of Oklahoma are probably one of the most important kind of New York experimental theatre groups. Like, you know, they're in the same kind of vein as, like, the same sort of fame, I say, as the Worcester Group, Richard Foreman and Richard Schechner. And that's kind of downtown New York theatre scene. So luckily, 20 years later, last April, we did a workshop at Nature Theatre of Oklahoma for 3 weeks, and because we're going to work on a project next year. So in that workshop, I realized, Anne Gridley will be a great Hermione. So we're delighted to have her here. And it's her a debut in Dublin. It's amazing to have this sort of experimental theatre legend on our doorstep.
For sure. And Hermione in The Winter's Tale. But in your version, as I say, it's called Exit Pursued by a Bear, to which we will come in just a moment. But Anne, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the Nature Theatre of Oklahoma, because you were one of the founding members of that particular company.
Yes.
And what Gavin has mentioned, this experimental side to it. What was that initial spark that caused you and others to found that company?
Well, many of us met in grad school. We all went to Columbia and sort of found one another there and started working together there. The first piece that we did under the name Nature Theatre of Oklahoma was a production of Three Sisters. But then the director, Pavel Lyshka, for his graduate thesis, wanted to make a piece with no text at all. And having no choreographic training at all, decided that he wanted to make a dance piece with four non-dancers, cue me and three other people, and taking movement from everyday life. But when you speed it up and put music underneath it, it becomes a dance to the audience, because they're seeing these repeated gestures. But they're really just like ways people stand, ways people sit, positions people take when they sleep. So that's how we found each other. And then, he was interested in storytelling and getting text rather than having, you know, somebody be a playwright and sit alone in a room in an attic somewhere and write a text by themselves. He wanted to generate text through recordings of everyday speech. So he recorded telephone conversations between him and people in the company or our families or our friends, and we use that text with all of the verbal nonsense that we I'm deliberately avoiding it now because I'm on the radio, but you know, all of the ums are like,
I'm well familiar with all of them. Use them on a regular basis myself.
Yeah, great. So we would use those, but to dramatic effect.
So I mean, as you describe it there, Gavin, and as Anne describes it, it is very easy, and people who know Pan Pan's work will see that it is very easy to see why the two companies veered towards each other. I presume you see that you saw the overlaps pretty quickly as well.
Yes. And I've certainly been aware of Pan Pan for years and years, but because Nature Theatre's shows tend to be quite long, you know, 3 hours or something, anytime we were at a festival or something at the same time, I could never see their shows. So I finally was able to see, now I don't remember which show it was, at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn when they came, and I didn't, my schedule was free, you know, I wasn't performing, I got to see.
So here we are, and what Anne has described with the way that the Nature Theatre of Oklahoma took those ums and ahs to make text, you're taking a great text, a difficult text, it has to be said, in The Winter's Tale. It's one of the late comedies, isn't it?
And
all that comedy means in this situation is it has a happy ending.
Exactly.
That's what we're talking about.
Correct, yeah.
They're often referred to as the problematic comedies. What's so problematic about The Winter's Tale?
It's referred to as the problem plays, a romance, and a comedy. It's obviously one of the late Shakespeare plays, 1610, 1611. And maybe you got to think of Shakespeare late in his life, wondering, like, I always think, what's he going to write about now? And it starts off as a tragedy. It's almost like starting off in Act 3 in Othello. It starts off like an action movie where this character, Leontes, suddenly accuses his wife of jealousy, who's 9 months pregnant, and then tries to have her killed. And then he tries to kill his daughter. And so it starts off with this terribly bleak, tragic moment. It's almost as if Shakespeare says, okay, let's get on with it. Let's have no exposition. Let's cut to the chase. And then suddenly 16 years of time pass, and then we're in this sort of comedy whereby these other characters in a different part of the world, in Bohemia, and this strange plot ensues where the young daughter who was abandoned, you know, actually it becomes a shepherd's daughter. They come back. It sort of goes on like this idea of almost like a quest. So I think Shakespeare was trying to look at, like, maybe what are the forms of theatre at that time in around 1611. So it becomes a sort of masque, music, comedy, dancing. And so you could argue this is Shakespeare, the avant-garde artist.
For sure. And the music that you have in there, I was kind of laughing, astonished, and delighted to see that David Essex opens.
Exactly.
Opens.
I mean, if you can't open a show with David Essex, you know, what can you do? You know,
well, so. When he said it was only the winter, or Winter's
it was only
Tale,
Winter's,
it was right there.
It gives it to you on a plate, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Absolutely.
And so, yes, it's sort of the notion that you know, the play is it's everything really. It's part poetry, part painting, part sculpture, part dance. And it's sort of, it is, you think of it like Shakespeare as the interdisciplinary artist. So the show is full of music. It's full of visual moments. It's full of poetry. And it's just like, it's a wild trip. But essentially, I think what you get is this amazing Shakespearean themes, you know, which always kind of makes it so contemporary to us. So it is about the big things like nature and art, death, jealousy, what it means to be a human being has always been, you know, upfront in Shakespeare's work. But this is really, it's a very, very strange and wonderful piece. So it's open to all kinds of interpretation, but it's still Shakespeare and the words are amazing. So it's that rigor of, like, you'll hear amazing Shakespeare, but you'll also hear, like, other things that happen. But it's, you know, it's amazing, some of the speeches, and it has some of the best, most amazing female characters in Paulina and Hermione with these terrific speeches. And you got to remember at the time, you know, women weren't supposed to speak. So the idea that Shakespeare gives all these huge speeches to these female characters is incredibly interesting.
Men playing the part, the female parts at the time. Hermione, just taking it outside of the avant-garde nature and the way Gavin has described this production, and Hermione as a character, the attraction to you in her, what would it be?
I mean, I appreciate her integrity and her singleness of purpose. It's very different for me. I am much less patient than Hermione is.
Because she's accused of being unfaithful and kind of get out of my life.
Yeah.
With your 9 month pregnant.
Right, in your 9 month pregnant state. Go to prison.
Yeah, see you around.
Have the baby in jail. I'm going to take the baby away and murder it. Spoiler alert, she's not murdered. But, yeah. You know, all of these horrible things happen, and she says, oh, well, I trust that Apollo and the Oracle will come through. And then when they do and exonerate her, Leonti still doesn't believe it. So I mean, I would burn something down, but Hermione is much more even keeled, I think.
And how, I mean, to give her that, though, that quality without making her some kind of passive vessel to be acted upon.
Right.
I guess that's the challenge in the part.
I think so, but I think that there are hints in Shakespeare, you know, she's not a pushover. She says, like, you know, I might not care about my life, but I care about my honor, you know. You've done all of these horrible things to me. Go ahead and kill me. Like, go ahead. I have no reason to live.
Yeah. Because you don't
believe
who I am.
You've taken all of this away.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can take my life too, but you can't take my honor. And she's able to say that very clearly in the courtroom scene, you know. She does have some little moments, some, maybe not barbs, but like...
Yeah, Shakespeare gives her some amazing language in that respect. I was actually quite impressed in what some ways, Gavin. It's a long time from I've read The Winter's Tale in the Shakespearean version, and I know there are other elements to it that you have lost with, or you've put to the one side for this production. But I thought the Shakespeare that we do get, it is truly the essence of certainly of the Hermione Leontes story, and where could she? There's a statue at the end. Spoiler alert, the statue is not, it comes to life. You know, all of these things which Shakespeare has in there, you seem to have had the essence of Shakespeare's words there, but you have lots of other words as well, including T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, there's lots of other words. I think it's, I find, because of the whole, I'm trying to connect to the big theme of the show, which is what is the nature of time? And there's a sense that this Winter's Tale is sort of post-time, post-tragic, and Shakespeare's really messing around with the idea of what is our perception of time and what is our perception of art. So with the T.S. Eliot poem that's included in the piece from Four Quartets, which is a perfect poem about time, time present, time past, and just that sense of like how words can change the meaning of time and how performance is all about time. And so there's something about trying to align itself, the Shakespeare words aligning itself with other poets that are in the piece, which just features Sylvia Plath, T.S. Eliot, and just figuring out like what is the modern voice for such a kind of, you know, esoteric concept. So I think it works very well because, you know, Shakespeare can take a lot of treatment. As you know, like, it's so rich, it's so strong.
Well, you've done this. You've done this with King Lear. You've done it with Hamlet, with lots of Shakespeare's.
We've had the luck of doing five or six other Shakespeare's, like Rehearsal in the Day, King Lear, Macbeth, and we've just kind of learned over the years that, like, even if you have one line of Shakespeare, it's still Shakespeare, but you can really, like, Shakespeare, you can hang a lot of clothes on Shakespeare.
Well, let's talk about possibly the most important line, which is the stage direction, exit pursued by a bear. Does everybody get to be, every character get to be a bear at some point in this production?
Well, it's definitely from the perspective of the bear. So, actually, it's bears playing humans. So the idea is that finally the bears get a chance to play the lead characters. And so it's bears going through the suffering of playing humans. And what you get then is a sort of slightly heartbroken version of the play. So if you can imagine if bears had to play humans and they realize, oh my God, humans are terrible. We're bears, we're much nicer. So it's sort of that idea of like turning nature on itself and allowing us to figure out that, especially because in Elizabethan times, you have to imagine that perhaps if you saw the show in the Globe, you could hear bear baiting in the distance.
Yeah, because there would have been bear baiting going on. First time to play a bear, I'm guessing, Anne?
Is it? Yes.
Yeah.
I have played other animals, but this is the first bear. Yes.
Nature Theatre of Oklahoma did not stretch to bears.
They didn't
put you in lots
bear.
Of other animals, but not the bear.
Right.
So that is why you're in Ireland.
There's a lot of very bad puns when you begin to play a bear.
I can imagine. Yeah. Yes, so we go on. I'll stop right there. Thanks to both of you for coming in this evening, Anne Gridley and Gavin Quinn. Exit Pursued by a Bear by William Shakespeare and Pan Pan. And lots of great music in there. jealous guy is in there too, is he?
Absolutely, you got to have a jealous guy. I mean, the whole theme of Winterstell is jealousy, so why not throw in jealous guy?
All right, so it runs as part of Dublin Theatre Festival at the White Recital Hall in the Royal Irish Academy of Music. It's there from October the 3rd through to the 13th. Further information on dublintheatrefestival.com. The broadcast ban introduced in the United Kingdom in 1988 led to actors overdubbing the voices of politicians and activists associated with the IRA when they appeared on television or radio. The ban encompassed loyalism too, but it affected Sinn Féin members perhaps the most, and it stood for 6 years until the 1994 IRA ceasefire. In the new documentary short film simply called The Ban, director Roisin Agnew has spoken to key figures from the time, Sinn Féin representatives, also journalists and of course actors who had to do all the revoicing, including Stephen Ray. The ban will be screened this Sunday as part of the IFI, the Irish Film Institute's Documentary Festival, and the festival runs from September the 25th through until the 29th. Delighted that Roisin Agnew is with me in studio this evening. This is such the story that you're telling in the film, Roisin, is such a kind of a blast from the past. How did you come across it? Because I don't think you were watching the news in 1988 when all of this happened.
No, I wasn't born actually when this came through. So no, I certainly wasn't there at the time. So I suppose sort of the vague long story around how I get to is that through my research, I'd become really interested in these different film collectives that were working in the 80s that I kind of saw as making a form of counter cinema. And it was a counter cinema that came out of kind of an anti-colonial, decolonial struggle that generally operated under the Workshop Declaration, which Channel 4 had brought in. Now, the Workshop Declaration was about basically democratizing filmmaking and TV making. It was about essentially providing kit, crew, and airtime, essentially, to underrepresented communities who would normally not get that space.
And I think there was a specific community and specific project in Derry then that you came to.
Yes, exactly. And so I became really interested in what was known as Derry Film and Video Workshop. And I was interested in sort of the alliances and solidarities that they shared with other collectives that were working within the workshop movement, such as Black Audio Film Collective that Jonah Comfer came out of, and Sankofa that like Isaac Julian would have come out of. And so I kept researching this, and as I was particularly interested in Derry Film and Video Workshop, who, you know, kind of their work, I suppose, traces the kind of linked heritage of Republican and feminist struggle in history. I was obviously watching their kind of seminal film, which is Mother Ireland, and researching it, I kind of discovered sort of its slightly complex broadcasting history, which was essentially, it featured an interview with Mairead Farrell. Mairead Farrell was an IRA volunteer, and 3 days after they had delivered the film with this interview as part of it, Mairead Farrell was actually killed by SAS in Gibraltar, and the film never was aired, and it wasn't aired because of the broadcasting ban.
And that ban came in 1988.
That came in now, 88, yeah.
October, lest people get confused, this is not Section 31 in the Republic of Ireland.
No.
It's a different thing, which we might touch on in a minute.
Yeah.
This is specifically the 1980s broadcasting ban brought in by Margaret Thatcher.
Douglas Hurd.
Douglas Hurd was the secretary,
Home Secretary
at the time. And effectively what it said was, well, you tell me, what did that ban say in terms of who could be heard or not heard?
So they basically brought in this law, the ban. They used both the licensing agreement and also the Prevention of Terrorism Act to bring in this ban that essentially didn't allow prescribed members of prescribed groups to be heard on air, and also certain representatives. But these included sitting MPs. And these sitting MPs were predominantly in Sinn Féin. They were the only people who were associated with a proscribed group, the IRA in this case. And in many ways, it was seen as essentially a measure to stop high-profile Sinn Féin MPs from being heard. And of course, Gerry Adams being the chief sort of target in this case.
And you managed to get Gerry Adams today to come and talk to you for the film.
Yes.
So what we're going to hear is a clip from the film here, which First of all, is Gerry Adams right now, or certainly at the point at which you were making the film, then Gerry Adams back in 19, just before the band came in back in 1990, well, in fact, yes, back, it's an original version that was never heard mm-hmm. because it wasn't allowed to be broadcast using his voice.
Exactly.
You'll hear him speaking. Then a third voice will take over, which is an actor, not mimicking him, just saying the words that he had already said in this interview.
It's not for me to say that my voice is particularly distinctive or not. It's the only voice that I have.
John, I'm optimistic because I come at this from a Republican perspective. We have been coming at these issues for almost a decade now of trying to get these core issues up on the political agenda.
So this year we managed through a series of initiatives and through just undaunting hard work and through the resilience of the Republican struggle to put these core issues and to focus the British government on those issues.
Well, a lot of people thought it was a great improvement, you know, on my monotone. People would bring it to your attention that there was a particularly funny, you know, or somebody, you know, somebody with a squeaky voice, or clearly not me for those who may have known me.
And there we go. That's a clip from the band featuring Gerry Adams today. Gerry Adams back in 1988, I think that was. And then Tim Lone was the actor who was voicing, who then voiced that interview that we heard the clip from.
Yeah.
He voiced that when it went out on the telly.
Yeah.
With me in studio this evening is Roisin Agnew, the director of a documentary on the band, which is the film simply called The Band. You went to the actors who, it was make hay while the sun shines, really, for lots of them in this case, wasn't it?
Yeah, it certainly was. I mean, that's kind of one of the pleasures of the story, I suppose, was to kind of look at this moment through the perspective of the actors who were brought in to dub all of these politicians and also basically provide the voice for also some pretty, obviously, quite terrible, you know, events that were happening. But as you said, like they were making hay, like they're very sort of open about the fact that this was a really good moment for them, that they were earning quite a lot of money and that they, as they say, operated as a flying squad. They'd all be in the BBC Belfast studios yeah. all the time, chain smoking, waiting to be called. And then as you hear in the film as well, they actually started competing with each other, getting pagers and answering machines, which in 88 wouldn't have been around yeah. all that often.
And the reality, as we heard there with Tim Lone, it wasn't about trying to mimic the voice. It was about something else. It was, and you get a sense of it there at the end of that clip. It's actually coming up in a later clip. I'll come back to it in a second if I get there.
Mm-hmm.
But I do want to listen to another little clip that you feature in the film as well. And this is a wonderful moment of comedy from the comedians Chris Morris and Steve Coogan, who are kind of making fun of the ban and what it was doing.
Sinn Féin have so far denied they are backing the campaign. Earlier today, I spoke to their deputy leader, Rory O'Connor, who under broadcasting restrictions must inhale helium to subtract credibility from his statements.
So you do support this campaign of violence?
Sinn Féin is a legitimate political party.
Which supports terrorist action.
Your tone is antagonistic and you're making me very angry.
There we go. So that is Steve Coogan and he sucks in the helium.
Yeah.
And then Chris Morris is doing the part of the interviewer there. This is from the film The Band, director Roisin Agnew with me in studio. And yes, there are great moments of levity like that. There are also the very human story of the actors. I mean, Tim Lone talks about before the ban was lifted at the time of the ceasefire, he was the person who was Gerry Adams' voice for the announcement yeah. of the ceasefire.
That his parents heard him when they were on holiday on the Today programme.
Yeah,
that's how they learned of the ceasefire. Yeah,
yeah. Which is, it kind of has a very peculiar feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, you are making a very serious point in the documentary as well about censorship. It was for all proscribed organisations at the time, which would have been across the loyalist community as well. Did you go there, or what kept you away from that side of the story?
We didn't. We actually made a choice that we were going to look at specifically, essentially, the journalists and the actors that were involved. And simply, there wasn't that much dubbing being done of loyalist politicians, not least because, like, the sitting MPs were Sinn Féin MPs, right? But it was also, we just did try to keep a narrow focus. I mean, when we started to do this film, we had a lot of different ideas around what we wanted to do. We wanted to focus on sort of talk about systematic media bias, all these different things that just fell out from the focus, you know. The main thing that we ended up wanting to look at was this idea of the voice. Because, you know, anyone who comes to Thatcher's broadcast ban, the first thing they want to ask you is why this focus on the voice rather than anything else. You
well,
know?
Let's listen to Stephen Ray, who was asked to voice an interview with Gerry Adams for Channel 4. And there's an interesting at the end of this about the voice and what that meant.
I'd been asked, would you come into a studio and revoice Gerry Adams? The idea was to speak with as much clarity as possible so that the words that he was saying would get through to an audience. And I left out little fluffs. I didn't repeat mistakes because he was talking off the cuff. What was I going to do? Say to her, oh, get Kenneth Branagh to do it.
What they objected to was these guys looking reasonable. These guys looking normal. Because if you're going to demonize terrorists, they can't be working class guys who can actually express themselves really well and are quick in debate.
I think the voice of Gerry Adams, they wanted to take it away. These figures were hugely charismatic.
And that's the point. It's Dennis Murray there at the end, isn't it, making that point, Roisin, about the charisma. That's what... So we were still hearing the exact words that were being said, but the charisma, the humanity was being taken out of the voice.
Exactly. And as you said, the humanity, I think, is kind of the main issue. I think, you know, the focus on the voice, it is hard to understand. And like, you know, as, you know, has been sort of discussed at length, is how farcical the actual ban and measure ended up being, you know, and that's sort of where our starting point is, right? We use the farce to kind of get into the more serious issues. And I mean, you know, the thing about taking away someone's voice and that kind of divorcing the body from the voice is an attempt to kind of take over meaning and remove it. And it's a manipulation and it is dehumanizing. And you have people talk about that repeatedly in the film.
All right. It's called The Ban, the title of this film that Roisin Agnew has been telling us about. It will be screened at the Irish Film Institute in Dublin this Sunday, September the 29th at 1:10, part of the IFI Documentary Festival. And Roisin will be there in a Q&A after the event with Stephen Ray and indeed former Sinn Féin publicity director Danny Morrison, who also we hear win the documentary. Information and tickets on IFI.ie. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Pauline McNamara. Speak to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.